Hi, this is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Rocking around the Christmas tree at the Christmas party hop. Mistletoe hung where you can see every couple tries to stop.
8:06 on a Tuesday. Joining me from someplace on the planet is Grant Newsham. Grant, good morning. Merry Christmas. How are you?
Good morning. Perfect. I thought I woke. It's 1 o'clock now, and I thought I woke up in 1956 just now.
You did. Come on.
Okay. I'm not dreaming. Okay.
You're not dreaming. Where are you? Where on the planet are you?
Okay. I'm just in Tokyo, but I was in Bangkok this weekend, of all places.
How wonderful. Good for you. What were you doing in Bangkok?
Every now and then I get invited to something to speak. I'm not on most people's lists because I've never quite mastered the yes man thing. But there's some nice German organization down in Bangkok that doesn't know better, so they invited me. Actually, the second time, so they do know better.
They do know better, but they still retain your services. And what did you speak on? What was the subject?
It was a U.S. perspective on threats to the global order in East Asia in particular.
Well, there's a relatively long list of those you can service. How long did you have to speak?
Oh, that makes it easy. 20 minutes, and then answer questions for an hour or so. But it's... they say that makes it easy, but
exactly.
It's a broad topic. So.
Exactly. And to think, you know, a few years ago you were talking about the Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force.
Uh-huh. Well, it's all you can twist anything into anything. So I could, it just gives you a lot to cover with, how the threats that not just us, but really the free world faces, sort of the modern equivalent of when the Mongols came pouring out of the east in the 13th century to go start Krakow. So I think we're just facing a current version of the same thing.
I know that's having Polish blood in you. I know that's still a sensitive wound for you. So, but, I don't think most people understand, and it's kind of interesting, the way history moves and the issues that we deal with, right? So now, as Americans, if they have any kind of intellectual curiosity, like why are we detaining the CEO of the CFO of a major Chinese corporation? What is that about? And then you hear this kind of drumbeat in a bipartisan way, louder than you've ever heard it. We can't go on with the theft of international property. We can't go on with Chinese industrial espionage. We can't go on economically with these forced technology transfers that China requires. At some point, China has to grow up and play by the rules that other civilized nations play by. And so it seems to me interesting that you have a much broader drumline beating that tune today than I've ever seen it, certainly.
Me too. That's just a few years ago, there was this huge constituency in the American business community in particular of everyone who liked to cheap labor costs in China, everyone who thought they were going to sell one of something to every Chinese person, that was really telling administrations to please don't say anything, just don't complain about what the Chinese are doing, even though they all knew it. Because they expected that someday they would all become fabulously wealthy in that market. Or, in the case of Walmart, they just wanted to be able to buy, to make stuff for almost nothing.
Right.
And then get America hooked on it, unemployed America mostly, and they would do very well in Bentonville, Arkansas, but everywhere else, not so much. But that has really changed. I'm not saying Walmart has changed. But I'd say now it seems that the majority of, say, American companies doing business in China or expecting to are indeed feeling the pain and almost like waking up and realizing they've been had. And they are actually, if not quietly supporting the administration, or they're at least some of them overtly supporting the administration, but they're all happy that Mr. Trump has finally sort of tried to defend American interests here. And just as I've said before, it's just ironic that it took a real estate salesman from Queens, a real estate developer from Queens, New York, to finally do what needed done. But you do have that shift of the business community is something which is new in the last 45 years of dealing with China. And also there's, I think that by and large, a good chunk of the Democratic Party and also the Republican Party too, which has been just as enthusiastic about appeasing the People's Republic of China, have seem to have swung in the right direction, and we'll see how this goes.
You know, I have listening to you, I'm recalling Orrin Hatch, who's a conservative from Utah. Okay, so I think saying conservative is redundant there. Okay, mm-hmm. It's assumed. So I remember him within the last year saying, "Look, these tariffs really concern me. I'm for open trade." And I found the comment laughable. If you think that that's open trade, right? I've got some coastal property in Kansas that I want to sell you, Orrin, because you're dumber than a bag of hammers. But this has gone on, and I would tell, I'll link the events that we've seen in France in the last week. When you've exported all your manufacturing, not all, but a good chunk of your manufacturing to a country that systematically restrains wages, right? And those jobs that used to support families and communities migrate to around the world. You can't replace those with jobs that support families, and now people are driving taxis, and they're Uber drivers, they're Lyft drivers, they're this, they're that. You can see when the middle class goes away, which Theodore Roosevelt wrote about extensively, and how important developing a large middle class for a country is, when that goes away, you see the shit that you see going on in France. And to me, you know, it's Mr. Macron's about face from a month ago today when he lectured the world about nationalism, right? I don't know that I've ever seen a faster about face. Like, yeah, I need to be a French nationalist. I need to tend to France. That whole globalism and that whole, you know, world environment, that can wait for probably another president on another date. But that ain't happening right now. Pretty stunning. And to me, at the root of it is a systematic Chinese plan to transfer, every bit of manufacturing they can to them. And it has impacted Western democracies, and much to the delight of the Russians who simply pour gasoline on all this stuff. So I don't know at what point of that PhD dissertation that you want to hop in, but feel free.
Well, I think you're right. This is the really the outcome of policy towards China, especially industrial policy. As sort of put forth by the our professional CEO and class and the MBA elites that chased cheap labor to China, willingly exported jobs that they didn't have to. That's the thing.
Right.
Certainly that sometimes a company properly does set up shop overseas, but this was done in the name of really chasing like a half a percent or 1% of return on equity, return on investment for a company. It just really is increasing the bottom line by a relatively small amount. And there's this mantra that you hear called shareholder value. And there's somewhere the idea came along that a company's or management's only responsibility is to shareholders. It's like a mantra. Nobody knows where it came from. But the hip class, all the business experts and the managers, they have all bought into this. And what it does, it increases their share options, increases their bonuses. But what it does is it guts the manufacturing class, people who work in factories, to put it simply, and all the factories that support those factories, and all the services and jobs that would say support a sort of a steel mill or a place that makes washing machines. So it just gutted these communities without. In this false notion that shareholder value is all that matters. And instead of thinking, well, if we take care of our employees, if we take care of the customers, the people who are going to buy our stuff, who live in these communities that depend on our businesses, our company, our factories, etc., then the shareholders are going to be taken care of. But if they've got it completely in reverse, and there's been a jobs do come and go to some degree in a well-run economy. MIT has a good study there claims that about 3.5 million manufacturing jobs were lost as a result of letting China into WTO and not requiring it to play by the rules everyone else was playing by. And those are jobs that didn't have to be lost. So take 3.5 million, and then suppose there's about 5 million, just say roughly, people who indirectly depend on those jobs that were lost. So you've got, you're getting up there to about 10 million people at least who've been affected, and just drive through the, say, eastern Ohio, western Pennsylvania, those areas, and you see what's happened. And it has just gutted as a worse than a war in some respects. And if you throw in the opioid crisis, most of which is based on these drugs exported from China, which kill more people each year in the last few years than have died in the Vietnam War, I think we have been suffering the effects of a war. So that's a very long way of saying, yeah, this has been crazy. And it has caused just immense harm to, I think, U.S. society. Does the classes on these upper classes or elite classes on the East and West Coast care? Not really. I think what you saw with Mr. Trump's election was effectively the lower orders uprising or a peasant revolt. And you're seeing the same thing in Europe now, both with Brexit and more recently with Macron in France, the problems there, and also what is dismissed or talked about worryingly as populism. Now, this is people who are tired of an elite class that has gotten things so wrong and has caused them personally just such misery and lack of opportunity. But so it's kind of interesting, and it's often a little hard to even understand what's happening, because in some respects it is historic, and it's not unlike what we've seen in the past centuries, as I said, when there's something like a peasant revolt against an elite class. So it's interesting in that respect, but didn't have to happen.
It's ironic that we laid President Bush to rest last week, and he was one of the people that opened the door to the Chinese and was adamant about, look, as they integrate into the world order, we will see less of this. And your thoughts on that are always amusing. We've been had. They had a plan all along, and they've executed their plan, and now we wake up. And it's interesting that the people that have been the most vocal, other than President Obama, about globalism, Ms. Merkel, you've seen, and Emmanuel Macron. I mean, Macron's not headed for the door yet, but Ms. Merkel, I mean, they're getting thrown out of office. And I think the violence that people have seen in France scares the living bejesus out of people.
It ought to.
Right.
But one does see that this is there's ultimately no consequences for the people who've been wrong. I'd say most of them are not malicious, but they've just been wrong. And their decisions have been harmful and caused just real damage to our societies. And yet, societies in the West or the free world, and they don't seem to suffer any ill effects for it. personally, and even ultimately, you'll find that the class that writes the narratives, their reputations will remain intact. Mr. Bush, who was by all accounts a decent fellow, and I even shook his hand once at the embassy in Tokyo.
Nice.
He was kind enough not to call me Shorty. He was a tall, tall gentleman. But he was wrong on China, and there were some other things he was wrong on as well, the foreign affairs. But taking China, I remember at the time of Tiananmen Square, I was working in the State Department, and I remember that some of our people coming back from the White House as this was happening and saying that President Bush just can't believe that his friends are doing this, like slaughtering their own people.
Right.
And the U.S. response to Tiananmen Square actually was to do as much as they possibly could to ensure that the Chinese Communist Party didn't suffer any effects and recovered from it. You know, this was just a mistaken bout of it was almost as if they thought the Communist Party was just acting up like children would do, and they just need to be understood and accommodated. And that's what the Americans did. The U.S. administration basically accommodated the Chinese, tried to apologize or excuse away what they had just done at Tiananmen Square, and as a result squandered an opportunity almost to have that country go in a different direction, or at least us go in a different direction towards how we were going to deal with them. But I remember that very well. And I don't think I was experienced enough then or familiar with the topics to realize that I was watching the game being thrown away at that point. So that was 30 years ago almost.
Right.
But I remember it perfectly.
And Bush's logical syllogism was the Chinese will evolve, include them in the WTO, the conclusion is therefore include them in the WTO, but they will evolve, they're not an evil country, and then the third minor premise is, as they integrate, they will evolve, therefore include them. That is wrong. That was wrong. That is,
there was no WTO then, but involve them, invite them in, make sure, help them feel comfortable in the global society, global economy, etc. But that's how it was, sort of a Will Rogers-esque kind of, that everybody's just a friend I haven't met yet. Well, not really.
Let me ask you one more question about France. I think, were I a globalist, somebody who espouses that, I would be very, very disturbed by what I've seen in France. I would see the broadening and deepening of the gap between the haves and the have-nots, and I would see the have-nots going into the street violently. Not only protesting and smashing windows, attempting to get to, you know, the French presidential palace. And I would see very disturbing things when people are that irritated, and it's not just a small group. The numbers of people that have gone into the streets have grown consistently every week, and those protests have expanded every week to other cities across France. To me, that undeniable wind that is circulating in France, I would think would be extremely disturbing to the quote unquote globalists. And again, I have Macron's words booming in my head about, you know, and I think he doesn't understand history well, but your first job as a president is to represent and to be the economic developer and job creator in chief for your country. That is your first job. All other things are subordinate to that. And it seems to me that this charade, and China's a big part of it, this economic charade that has gone on, where the transfer of jobs out of industrial countries into underdeveloped countries, which is normally the march of time, but it happens at a slower pace because people do protect themselves. This has done significant damage to economies around the world, and it'll be interesting to see to what lengths Macron will go now to get the lid on this, and if he did not wait too long to react to it. I'm curious, as you've watched the whole thing in France spool, your thoughts, will he weather the storm? Will he leave?
I don't think he'll survive this. When you've got a support rating of, 23% or so, right? I have a hard time seeing how he will survive. I think he and that ruling class that he represents, they will do everything they can to sort of maintain the status quo, I say, to placate the peasants or the lower orders and just try and buy them off enough that it kind of goes away. But I don't think it will. You look at, it's almost, in some ways, it's like a game of musical chairs, and this system that has really benefited a connected elite or anyone has. It's fine. I don't wonder if it's gone on. Just it can't go on any longer. That it's that you have this, as you said, the scale of the unrest in France is significant, noteworthy. But you also look at the opinion polls and the reports on how many people support them throughout society, and it really does reflect a broad range of society, not just this incredibly deprived extreme at one end, but rather it's much wider than that, and geographically there's a lot of support for it. And I don't think he's going to survive. How this is going to play out, I don't really know, not just in France, but throughout Europe. And even in the United States, one thing I did get a sense of that I had never had when I guess it was, almost 18, 19 years ago when I went to work for a Wall Street firm, is that I had never realized just what a different universe that is, where the amounts of money people are making are just so great that you can't quite conceive of it. Plus, there is a sense, and I did get the sense, that for anyone who'd gotten their snout into that trough, who is benefiting from it, they generally didn't really care about anyone else in what I would call those other people. And that other people includes, say, people living on government salaries, doing pretty well, but live just anyone but that class. And I think Silicon Valley represents it as well. They really didn't care about them. I just don't quite know how to put it. But that was a real surprise to me to realize this and to get a sense that our society was being hollowed out with a very rich elite and then a very poor other end of it. And then in between these people who are just losing ground, whose opportunities were disappearing. And I think I can say fairly confidently that nobody cared. You'd hear these expressions, flyover country, right, for that part of America, which is basically everything except on the coast, that these people didn't even care about. I consider that just as insulting and malicious an expression as, say, James Carville, the Democratic strategist from the Carter era, referring to people as trailer trash. Which he got away with and never got any criticism for, but he certainly deserved it. So that's just my take on it. And where this will play out, I have no idea. I'm less certain of that than I am that the Redskins ain't going to the Super Bowl this year.
The Redskins, we have to talk about the Washington Nationals at some point. To me it's fascinating history that seems to kind of snuck up, and the issue of China and the economic transfer of industry in that direction. And then you're watching, as you said, the growing members of the shrinking middle class and the growing number of people that are in that bottom class, whatever you want to call it, of people that are losing economic hope. They don't see a path to a job that's a union job that's going to, you know, so I can go on vacation, so I can save some money, so I can retire. They don't see that anymore. They see, you know, a career as an Uber driver. So to me, that I find it very interesting in terms of current events, how all of a sudden, you know, you have very disturbing images coming out of France and people looking and going, oh, my God, you know, he's totally misread the economic condition of his nation and the mood of the population. If these kind of riots can occur week after week after week, and it mirrors the same kind of win that Ms. Merkel is fighting in Germany. And they've for so long, people have tried to poo-poo it as these, right, as you said, trailer trash, these people that live in flyover country. But if you lived, and I lived in North Dakota in a town of about 70,000 people for 14 years, they've lived this, right, with agriculture shrinking, with the mechanization about agriculture that doesn't require as many people. You know, and there's a saying in small town America, you know, last person who leaves, turn the lights on. As these towns have simply gone away, and they're sick of the things that have got said in Washington, D.C., we understand, we feel your pain. No, you don't. And that's why, to me, Donald Trump got elected. And people that don't understand that need to go to the Midwest, where millions and millions and millions and millions of Americans live, and they're tired of this. And you see that same sentiment in France, and you're seeing it in Germany, but it's routinely dismissed by the elites of the Western world. And now it seems like, for whatever reason, you're watching this, and it's like, whoa, look what's going on in Germany. Holy shit, look what just happened in France. You know, Donald Trump's in the United States. What's going on here? And so I think it's very interesting. And again, in my opinion, China's central to all of it because of its longer-term policies, and they've worked. And now you somehow or other have to turn it around.
I would agree that it does track back to China in a lot of ways. But partly, I would suggest, because of the sheer scale of China, it's hard. You have to keep that in mind, that it's just so big that when America's and the West started really exporting jobs unnecessarily to chase shareholder value and bonuses, that you do enough of it over time, and it adds up. You know, the damage becomes much more severe and widespread than it would be, say, if you were shifting jobs to Zimbabwe, where there's only so many you can shift.
Right.
But China can absorb any number, anything that we could send them, could make it more cheaply, could make it kind of well enough to work. And say over time, the doubt you start, hurting you start causing it over time, the effects really become apparent incredibly widespread. But it is that it's the scale of China, plus combined with sort of their government policy of trying to really build up their industry and not just compete with other industries, but to destroy it. And that exacerbates things, and I think it does track back to China, both the scale and the length of time that sort of a ruling class has been aiding and abetting China in destroying sort of that the flyover country, the lower orders in America.
And then and then saying things like I'm for open trade, I'm for free trade.
That's a mantra, and it's people who don't think about it and certainly don't experience the results of their policies, and they were simply wrong.
Right.
You know, say that's the at some point, you know, if they've had nearly half a century to see if this science experiment was on track, they might have realized some years ago that it wasn't and have rethought the hypothesis. But when, you know, for whatever reason, you know, that ruling business and political class and academic class got it completely wrong, and yet you'll find very few of them actually have to live with the results of being wrong. But and I think somebody, if you were 2,000 years old, you'd probably know of like 30 or 40 similar sort of events in sort of history,
right,
where something like this is happening. But since we bathe every day and dress more nicely and have iPhones, we don't think that we have anything in common with anybody who's come before us.
All right, I want to switch gears. Oh, I got an email that's asking you a question. Has Grant read books by Kurt Eichenwald, New York Times writer with epilepsy, about corrupt American businesses trying to fix the prices of international trading? And then I guess the title of one is called The Informant.
No, I haven't. I haven't heard of it. Might have to look it up and see. It sounds good. Guy who's worth reading, and he's actually a reporter on a related company. I'd call it that elite class corruption. And as it affects us, is a reporter named Matt Taibbi, T-A-I-B-B-I, M-A-T-T-T-A-I-B-B-I. And he wrote for Rolling Stone, and I think he still does today. He left for a little while. But his coverage of the financial collapse in 2008 was the best there was. And then he wrote a 10-year retrospective just recently, which is out there, on the 10-year anniversary of the financial collapse. And if you read it, your blood will boil. But it is so well done that I highly recommend it. But I must look up Kurt Eichenwald as well. But the Matt Taibbi stuff, both the recent sort of anniversary piece, but also what he was writing at the time of the financial collapse, is really worth taking a look at.
All right. How do you spell his last name again? Matt?
T-A-I.
T-A-I.
B-B-I. Matt Taibbi.
Matt Taibbi. All right. Yeah. I just sent you his name so I would remember it, just so you're not confused. Switch gears. The Justice Department took into custody the chief financial officer of one of China's leading companies. We know that if the Justice Department did that, the rap sheet must be like, if you drop the scroll, it would look like My Sins as St. Peter holds the scroll, right? It hits the ground and it starts rolling down the slope. Talk to us about what the Justice Department did. And its effect on all of this that we discuss, really. Economic relations, China's coming out party, and people starting to say, you know what, we played this game with China for too long. It's time that you come into the 21st century. Well, actually, it's time that you come into the latter 20th century, and then we'll drag you into the 21st century. But you will not define the rules that the game is played by, no matter how many people you have in your country. So tell us about what the Justice Department did. Can explain it to us.
Okay. Boy, there's I think when we sort of followed this a bit, so we can throw out the words Huawei and
right,
this sort of thing, and we kind of know. There's a Chinese telecommunications company called Huawei, H-U-A-W-E-Y, and it has gone in about 20 years or so to be with them, one of the major telecommunications providers, particularly hardware, around the world. They make stuff that works, and it's cheap, of course. This company, all of them, it has benefited from immense government support. It's just any unlimited funding, pretty much, and that's really helped it. It's incredibly corrupt. It pays off everybody it possibly can in anywhere it does business, and particularly it's in the so-called developing world, third world. It's pretty much amoral, and it's really gone from nothing to really being a global player. And that's, sometimes that happens. But this is not an entirely natural event, but it is the result of Chinese government support, bribery and corruption, et cetera, to get to get business, and that's, if you're an honest company competing with them, that's not a fun thing to deal with, but it's pretty much the Chinese MO. Huawei has done a couple things that has gotten U.S. government attention, one of which is all the bribes and the corruption which goes on, but it is also considered a security risk, as it effectively represents the Chinese government. And you could think of what you can do if you have telecommunications hardware plugged into telecommunications networks all over the world, including, say, countries like Britain, Australia, America. Any clever intelligence service can do all sorts of things, and both in the immediate term, in terms of surveillance, but also in the event you have a contingency that you can make problems start to happen. But Huawei its global reach is almost out of a James Bond movie in terms of those kinds of sort of overarching sort of criminal groups that can do things to the free world. And any one good example I like of what they've done to the developing world is they've offered the Organization of African Union, they offered them like a free they do their telecommunications network at their headquarters. The whole thing is hopelessly compromised, so basically China listens in to everything that the Africans are doing. And believe me, they haven't. That isn't the only place they've done it. Every time politicians go up to Capitol Hill or they get an intelligence brief on what Huawei is up to and has been doing throughout its entire existence, they come back horrified. And I've had it explained to me in early 2000s when Huawei was in the news by a guy who knows this stuff, and you almost want to cry. They've been so successful in insinuating themselves and pretty much getting control, or certainly, I don't know if control is the right word, but incredible access and an ability to manipulate the global telecommunications system. And that was in 2003, and they've had another 15 years to really go at it. Now, they've also have, as part of their MO, they've done business with Iran and other sanctioned nations, and that is what the chief financial officer, who is the daughter of the founder of a PLA, People's Liberation Army veteran, an electronics guy, that the Americans got the goods on Huawei and her involvement in sanctions busting against Iran. And that's what's been released in the press. I would hope that the Justice Department has got a lot more than that, and has got the goods on her. What they did is they asked the Canadians to arrest her or detain her as she was transiting planes in Vancouver, Canada, because she apparently has arranged her travel schedule in recent times, so she doesn't go anywhere near where the Americans might get her. But America has an extradition treaty with Canada, so the Americans made the request, and they provided enough information, I'm sure, they have to, that made the Canadians think that there was something to this. So Canada has detained her. There will be a bail hearing first and then an extradition hearing, and this is going to take a little while. But this is just the Chinese have gone berserk over this. So Huawei is seen as a threat. This isn't because it's a commercial threat. It really is the corruption, the intelligence risks that come of having Huawei hardware, and the just brazen flouting of global sanctions and also U.S. sanctions against Iran is what has got the CFO arrested. And we'll see how this plays out. But this is definitely America standing up for itself and landing a punch. And so we'll see. I would imagine that the hostage taking will start as the Chinese have been doing for years. They'll grab some foreigners and probably Canadians and probably some Americans and sort of try to trade them. These are, as I say, just the Mongols in the 13th century and the way they're behaving.
The what's been to me very interesting about it, Grant, is there has not been a hue and cry from Washington, D.C. that the Justice Department overstepped. It's been oddly silent for a case that really kind of sticks their, you know, sticks its finger right in the chest and the eye of the Chinese. It's been oddly silent from both Canadians and American politicians.
Anyone who gets those briefings, they just come back, you know, speechless. And you'll notice that even the Australians have recently declared Huawei cannot participate in the sort of the next generation telecommunications infrastructure in Australia. Even the New Zealanders have been subverted considerably by the Chinese, they have made a similar decision. The British have been slow to get at it, but they too are kind of peeling back or pulling Huawei hardware out of their networks, the Canadians as well. There's a good chunk of the civilized world that has finally woken up. You know, really, think of it, though, as a drunk man who's coming out of a hangover. he's starting to rouse himself from a stupor. That's about where we're at. And he's been, like, drunk for... He's been on what used to be called a bender, I think, by our parents. Yes, he's gone on a bender for, a couple decades.
Yes.
And he's just now, you know, sort of sobering up a little bit. That's about where we are. But Huawei does typify sort of the high-tech threat. And, you know, in some respects, you got to hand it to them, the Chinese. If you can get away with it, if you're dealing with idiots, why not play it? You know, and one would hope we would do the same thing. If we had the opportunity.
Email question. From one of my Marines, my former Marines, used to call me sir. Now he's routinely disrespectful to me. Grandpa Mac, you are absolutely right. Grant makes us all smarter about APAC affairs. Can you ask who or which countries are going to back us the most against China? It would seem other countries like Japan have been much better partners to the United States and have a lot to gain by the current situation. Does he envision another country making a play, or is China just too large to make up any ground against?
Well, good question. In terms of the only country I'm sure of is probably Texas. it's a good question, and I think a lot of people ask it all the time, or at least wonder it. Have we waited too long? I'd like to think we haven't. I don't think the game's over, but it is. It's the late innings. It'd be better if we had started playing defense in the and offense in the second inning at least. But I think in Asia that we're likely to get have our best prospects for some assistance from Japan. I think the Australians ultimately can be counted on. Maybe New Zealand will wake up, but you'll notice, those are sort of the ends of the region. Who else is, like, for sure on board? You'll notice I haven't named a whole lot of names. I think Singapore there's some prospects for that, although, you know, they feel the pressure and they understand how much trouble China can be.
Okay, let me stop you because I want to... I have not had you on to talk about this, but the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, what, Grant, 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago, released a report, and the Washington Post actually wrote, you know, an editorial about it, but the report is entitled Chinese Influence and American Interest Promoting Constructive, the term they use is constructive vigilance. And it was astounding to see just the way they put it in the front window. This is what America confronts today and the Western world confronts today. And we have got to stop sticking our head in the sand as these things continue, because the Western world cannot live with this. And it was interesting how loud the voice was, and the group that published it is widely, widely respected in terms of experts on China, whatnot, are not, cannot be dismissed as simply right wing, you know, drum beaters, blah, 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 blah. I'm curious about what you thought about that, because all of this plays in. And one of the interesting things I saw when I watched the media event that they did was the Australians have encountered this influence campaign that the Chinese wage in a big way in their country because of proximity and because of the number of Chinese, both ethnic Chinese that live there and then Chinese students that come to be educated there. If you're ethnic, and they talk about the Australian guy on the panel said, look, what you need to understand is China does not recognize you as a Chinese Australian, as a citizen of Australia. You are Chinese, therefore, you are Chinese first. And that's what these people get. And so they looked at the influence operations that were going on in their universities. They looked at their influence operations that were going on in sometimes in their political events. And they said, hey, we've got to put an end to this. Your thoughts about what the Hoover Institution published, and because you just mentioned Australia, made me think of it.
Okay. First of all, I'll finish up that email question first. I think if America can demonstrate that it is serious about taking on or asserting its interests, protecting its friends, and that it's committed to doing it in the long term, I think eventually we'll get some more support from within Asia. And once Singapore, Vietnam, maybe Indonesia, maybe the Indians will get into a degree as much as they can. But if we can demonstrate our commitment, then we'll find that we have more support. And I think it's proportionate to that, because I wouldn't be inclined to anger the Chinese if I wasn't sure the Americans were going to be around.
Right.
So that's the way to look at it. I didn't want to be entirely pessimistic.
No, but we should shouldn't we expect them to be late to the party? Because they can't be. They can't. They will get economically crushed. I don't understand. It seemed to me the Indians would want to be early to the party, because I think that which migrates from China might find a home in India, and because India is slower developing at a slower pace. I'm puzzled why the Indians don't get on board quicker.
India has always been very leery to take sides on almost anything,
right.
But you tend to play the middle, and they can't help themselves, and they've got their reasons for it. But I think at the end of the day, there's not a whole lot of love lost, and the more China intrudes in the Indian Ocean and the Indian Ocean region, I think India will be more helpful than it's been, but there's probably limits. So I just wanted to throw that in.
Before we move on to the Hoover Institution, does Japan see this as part, this conflict, economic, diplomatic, as part and parcel of the territorial confrontation that they will certainly have with the Chinese in the East China Sea, so they would be on board with it?
Some of them do. I think a lot of Japan does. Within Japan's ruling class, just like ours, manifested particularly with the Wall Street financial crowd, there is always a substantial constituency which calls for placating China, stressing the supposed economic benefits of it. So there is a pro-China constituency in Japan, but fundamentally, when you scratch everything away, I think there is a real fear and resentment of Chinese behavior. So I see Japan as, you know, in our camp, and vice versa, as long as we can demonstrate once again that we're committed to this, and that we're not going to say leave at some point and lose interest and leave them to fend for themselves. So that's my take on that.
All right, now to the Hoover Institution. What were your thoughts on that?
Okay, these people make me feel really smart. It was indeed a collection of luminaries in terms of China policy, both, you know, the diplomatic, government, academic, the commentariat. I mean, these are people who've been considered the players. And they have almost all of them, if you go down the list, not in all of them, but I'd say the vast majority have basically been appeasers of China forever, and have been directly involved in U.S.-China policy. and commenting, and they have been the ones who've gotten us into this mess. There's no nice way to put it. These have been the appeasers. You hear the expression, panda huggers. I don't, you know, that's a not a word I use, but I think appeasers is better. Is that, guess it right. And these people were entirely wrong. And now they have suddenly woken up and said, you know, China's kind of a threat. And it does raise the question, well, if you were, you know, didn't you notice this sooner? And also, how did they treat people who had different assessments, who had different perspectives on the threat China posed, and also how to deal with China? They dismissed them, ridiculed them, ostracized them, ignored them, and made sure that those people were kept out of the club and were not allowed to really have any much influence at all. And that should not be forgotten. The intellectual sort of, I don't know, dishonest, the intellectual, I don't know, bullying and maliciousness. Okay, now that said,
wow.
Finally, and I'm not overstating it, you know, that's how bad it was. So this would be almost like a pilot crashes his aircraft, and somehow he survives, but most of the passengers are dead, and he gets out, and then he takes a job as an advisor on flight safety. But that said, at least these people, you know, who have been are considered players,
right?
Though they don't, you know, that doesn't mean they know what they've been doing. But they've woken up, and it gives you a sense of just how things have shifted in the United States. That very different than a year or two ago. So to have these people say, boy, China's a threat, even if they don't say that we were mistaken, that this is a good thing. And they've written, I think parts of the report are pretty good. And there are some excellent people who are not, who have not been appeasers on the list. But there's also, Nate, that I'm surprised is when you look at this list, it doesn't include, I can't think of anyone on it who, what you call this, one of those people who were ostracized and who were right. The people who've been right all along, they're not on the list, which does surprise you. But it is a pretty good report, and it does show how things have shifted. It is kind of worth a look. It's kind of long, but you know, maybe you can read quickly. But the important thing is to know that a big chunk of people who've been appeasing China for decades have now kind of woken up. You mentioned Australia, and yes, they did, within the last few years, they've kind of wised up to what China was doing to subvert their politics and public opinion, and also to get inroads into Australian industry, natural resources, etc., that was not healthy. But one part of this is that you mentioned a lot of Chinese living in Australia, and a lot in New Zealand, it's similar. There is a large immigrant population. Some of it more recently arrived. Some of it been there a long time. And there's also a ton of students who are studying in Australia. It's important to remember that what the Chinese do, the Chinese government does, is it sort of subverts and exerts control over the local Chinese population. And it does this with threat of violence, actual violence. It applies pressure on these people's relatives back in China. In the student populations, you'll have these student informants who will tell the local Chinese consulate which students are saying bad things or criticizing China. They will attack professors who make just say the most sensible things about China. But because they're perceived as critical, they will raise these human rights protests with the administrations in their universities. The administrators want these Chinese students who are paying full tuition,
right.
And as a result, the administrators will knuckle under. So you find within the Chinese population, it's worth remembering that vast majority, the overwhelming majority, left China because they wanted to be free. And now you have the Chinese Communist Party thugs following them around and really strong-arming them, intimidating these people into either being quiet or even working for the Chinese. And that's where the Australians and the Americans ought to, they should arrest some of these people, send them right home. And any student who causes trouble, send them home. The local Chinese would love this. But they need some help from their governments, and this is something that hasn't gotten a whole lot of attention. But you see it on American campuses as well. So all in all, the Hoover Institution thing was interesting. It made me feel really smart. I figured this out well over 20 years ago, and so did a bunch of other people.
But Grant, one thing you've made us smart about is that for to not figure it out meant that you had to have your head so far up your ass, right, that it was astounding.
I think in common parlance.
You're a little bit more refined. You would say it a little bit more eloquently than I just did.
There's no other nice way to say it. That's what's been going on. There's another angle to this, and that is there's this wonderful Australian lady named Robin Lim, who was a professor and also had been an Australian intelligence officer. She's not really in the game anymore, but she would always say, look at who's paying, look at where their money's coming from. And that, if you look at who is paying, where somebody gets their money from, it's surprising how often that manifests itself in their position on China. And really only, it only seems to work, the sense that if somebody's really, has been accommodating and an appeaser, there's usually a financial angle to it, and you see this in academia, business community as well, particularly the retired government officials as well. If they're getting money, you will look at where their money's coming from, and very often you can predict what their position on China is going to be. So that's just part of it. Not in every case. Some of it is just simply being wrong. For whatever reason, but in a lot of cases there is a financial angle. You really see this in Australia as well.
I think what Deep Throat's immortal words, right? Follow the money.
That works. It makes people like you and I seem intelligent.
All right. Well, first of all, Grant, Merry Christmas. Thank you very much for again. You have a huge fan following. I don't know if you know this on All Marine Radio, but somebody who has a clear-eyed view, who's been in the region for a long time, but just you've made us all so much smarter about the Pacific Rim, and whether we're talking about North Korea, Japan, the South China Sea, or the events surrounding China. It's a delight to have you on, and I just wanted to say thank you, because I love when these things happen around the world. For instance, the Huawei thing, you come on and footnote it and make us all smarter. So on behalf of your many fans, thank you very much.
Oh, this is funny. I appreciate it. Since I'm always half awake when I'm talking, I think you and me are the only people on the planet awake.
No, I have a disrespectful former corporal that loves you. Guys, Bob Nielsen is your biggest fan. He's a former Turner Construction guy, so has been around the world and dealt with the Chinese, and says that guy is as smart as anybody I've ever heard talking about China, and he tells the truth, which is something that a lot of people don't do, even though they know the truth. So he's a huge fan of yours. He'll listen to this like three times, and then he'll email me all throughout the day. Hey, Grant, rah, rah. I said, look, does your wife know about your inappropriate affection for Grant? She's like,
There's nothing wrong with this. I appreciate it.
All right, Grant. Well, thank you very much. Have a great day.
I go. Uh-huh. Okay, bye-bye.
There you have it. Grant Newsham here. Pretty interesting, the events that are going on in the world right now. And, I think a lot of us have looked at this whole notion of globalism and the Coke song being played in the background and all of that, and thought, how can this work? How does this work? And you know what the answer is? The answer is it doesn't work. And the reason it doesn't work?
I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love.
Is because as soon as there's trouble at home, right? Then what you get is we don't give a shit what goes on in Germany. We want jobs in France. We want better lives in France. Okay? So knock this crap off. All right, we'll take a break. Grant's a smart. Now, you know what? He is a pragmatic, and I will tell you this. It's not like other people didn't know what Grant knew. You know, when he'd come on, he'd been coming on here for almost 3 years. It's not like other people don't know it. But as he said, intellectually dishonest. Maybe he didn't say this. I will. Intellectually dishonest. Too much money to be made in China, to tell the truth. And I think that is absolutely spot on. Too much money to be made in China to tell the truth or to treat them the way they should be treated. All right, with that said, Gunner joins us next. Don't touch that dial.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute. Heard every Wednesday right here on All Marine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it. The McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on All Marine Radio, on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.
Find all of Tim McGarry's contact information on the Readboard page at allmarineradio.com.